Accession number 10165, reel number 39.
Martin McLean, reel 39. You were telling me about this attack and the problems that you were facing.
I dragged the company commander up through the dry river beds. It was quite a heavy job because although you're training and carrying a man, invariably you'd carry them on a drill square, but when you drag them up dry river beds and what have you, two river beds, I had to take them up and hand them over to the air company. A company commander there grabbed the company commander and they got the stretcher bearers on there because they weren't involved in the attack. They were in defensive. They were all ready set. And the company commander gave me a huge tot of rum. And I said, oh, that's lovely, sir. What? When you get that, he says, you should have had it before you went in the attack. Now, this shows you the diligence of different people. My CQMS failed to get the rum up to us prior to the attack. Now, I knew not about the rum. Now, the attack, it was strong army rum, and it would have done the men a world of good if they had it. It would have given them a bit more to steady their nerves and things, but we never got a drink of rum. Well, I'll tell you the story later. I keep saying that, but I can't deviate. And then I ran back to the company, and our company HQ, they were petrified, the lads, because I'd left them, and they were young national servicemen, all of them. And I said, don't worry, lads, we're all right. And I laid down on the bank, and the set was going, the CO was talking on the set. He says, Samadji, I told him about the company commander being wounded and out. He says, get the men moving, you get them moving. I said, there's not a sound of a shot being fired. There's something drastically wrong, sir. He says, you get them moving. Well, as he said this, I was leaning against a low, shallow, dry river bed about the height of that thing there, but it was sloping top. And I was leaning against it when a shell, one of our own maybe, or a Japanese shell, hit the ground just above my head. Well, I don't know if you know much about shells, but they're a percussion fuse. And as soon as they touch the ground, they blow up and out, not down. They blow mainly out, but the fuse will go on the ground. And this huge explosion above me and shrouded us in dust. And I was, I'd say, unconscious for a moment. And I came round, looked round, all the men were all right. They were shocked. You know, we'd had a near miss. That's all about. That's war. We have to get over it. And then we found the set wouldn't work. The piece of shrapnel we didn't know had gone in the and through the set and stopped it working. I could hear the CO talking. He couldn't hear me talking. With the mystery of it, we don't know. So I says to the men, you stay here. Get yourselves up on the top there and watch out. If there's anything come, have a go at them. I said, I'm going round to catch the platoons. So I ran away round a dry river bed. Now, we were taught never to go without taking an escort with you. Always go in pairs. Well, I went on my own because I had no escort. And I ran around a dry river bed. The Japs were just up on the top. I'm not trying to be a hero. I'm just telling you, actually, really, truly what happened. And I'm a God-fearing man that can get a Bible. I run along in front of the Jap positions in the dry river bed, and I come to a stretcher, and on it was lying Lieutenant Greenwell. I told you about the man who twinkled in his eyes when he said, fill your whiskey with that water. He was wounded. It turned out he had 200 pieces of a grenade in him, one of the Japanese plastic grenades. He was out, and he was lying there smoking. He says, well, Sergeant Major, he's just a newly married man. He's stroking his old man. He says, they didn't hit that. And I said, right, sir. And I left him. And I went round to where his platoon were. The men were standing line, I should say. And in front of them was a lot of dead men. Dead, our men. Dead. Stone dead. No movement. I looked at them. About seven of them. And I shouted, come on, lads. Bayonets on. We've got to get in. And it was I thought it was Sergeant... I forget names now, but I thought it was one of our sergeants who he got the MM in some action somewhere. Got his name for the time. I've got a letter from him in there where he tells me the same thing in my cool house. I'm pointing the cool house. That's where I keep all my rubbish. It was where we kept the cool. Here's Thompson's submachine gun wouldn't fire. So it was Corporal Patterson I was talking to, not the sergeant. I said, because my eyes weren't right. I didn't know it. I didn't know it later with this explosion. And I said to the corporal, come on, corporal, get these men. Get on, men. We're going in. And the corporal says, wait, somebody, wait. And he's appealing to me. He says, don't, wait. He says, the Bren guns won't fire. The rifles won't fire. Well, that's unbelievable for a sandwich of the army. So I get down behind the Bren and put a fresh magazine on fire, and the round, you could hardly feel any explosion. It happened, but the round went out, but the gun jammed solid. So I tried bringing the cocking handle back. Now, we are taught, if a gun on fire, hit the gun and fire again. If it stops the second time, you change the magazine. So I'd done this IA, but I couldn't get the cocking handle back. So I brought the gun back off its forward position, and I had to use force to knock the cocking handle back. And it's the only piece of metal sticks out there, and I got it out. And I didn't bother anything then. I said, it's gas ports. On a gas port, it's a lack of gas that fails to drive the working portions back. So I changed the gas port to a smaller gas port, so the working parts would come back harder and drive the round out. I put a smaller aperture in. I fired again, I got the same results. So I changed the magazine and tried again. Exactly the same results. So I slung the gun aside in disgust, and I said, give us a rifle. I fired a rifle, it fired, but I couldn't get the bolt back. It stuck solid. The bolt, it had flicked up a little bit, but it hadn't come back. So I had to pull it back and kick the bolt handle to get the thing back. I knew an attack was impossible then. We had no support and weapons against any counterattack. Apparently, I might as well fill you in here now. These men who are out in front, they had known that the guns wouldn't fire. And then when they went to the first attack, the guns wouldn't fire. So Sergeant Scott and another Lance Sergeant with them, and the men, they went in with grenades. They collected the grenades off this other sergeant, who I told you about, is Thompson's submachine gun, who was with another platoon. He wasn't involved in our battle. He wasn't involved in the attack. They got all their grenades off them, so they could go in and attack these bunkers with the grenades. But they were killed by all this fire coming down from the hills and this covering fire from the other position. They ran into a trap. It was no good then, so I run past Company HQ and told them, I sent a runner back to Company HQ. I said, Lieutenant Greenwood's out, and the platoon has suffered some heavy casualties. And I didn't tell him about the ammunition. I ran round the other platoon, and you never saw anything like it in your life. They were in a dried river bed, and the walls are so steep, they must have been 10 or 12 foot high, and it was a sheer wall of soil and clay and tree roots and things like that. And they were trapped in there. They couldn't get out, couldn't get over with all their kit. There was a river wall here, but there was a smaller inlet that ran up there, which was full of gorse and bracken and bramble and everything that the Japs had put in to stop people going up that way. This is what we know now. And when these lads got in the dry river bed, they got showered with grenades, and they were just nearly annihilated. There was dead, there was wounded all over the shop. The company command, the platoon commander Freeman was wounded, so that's all the officers out. And I said to him, I said, sir, what? This is awful. I said, the war upset the loss of so many great men. I said, anybody out? And I put a Bren gun up, Beeson, and I put another Bren gun up on another side. I didn't know, actually, that their Bren guns wouldn't fire either. But I put them up with Bren guns to give us covering. I said, no, I'm going to try and get the men out. Stay here. I said, I'm waiting to get covering fire. We're going to withdraw. Attack was off. And I don't care if I'd been court-martialed. There was no attack coming from us, not without support and weapons. So I don't know how I got in contact with the CEO. I think the signal has got the set working. And I was talking to the CEO, and I said, sir, will you send down SOS fire by the Royal Artillery? I said, we've got to withdraw. Oh, the CEO went berserk. He says, I'm not going to have that, you know, all this sort of talk you get from them. It's all right for them talking. They were behind. I said, sir, the attack has completely failed. The Bren guns won't fire, the rifles won't fire. Nonsense! Well, I'd kept one of the rounds, the rounds that wouldn't fire. And later on, I examined them of the gun. The casing was so weak brass that when the round fired, the cordite inside this case swelled the case out over, but didn't expel the round properly, because the brass was supposed to be so thickness to contain that cordite. And it was swelling against the breech, the tapered breech of the gun, and it just wasn't coming out. So the guns weren't firing. All this brand new ammunition, useless. And so I told the CEO, he just wouldn't believe it. No more could I believe it. Were Tommy guns wouldn't fire? Were Bren guns wouldn't fire? Rifles wouldn't fire. The 10 platoon had used all the grenades they had nothing.
And they all used the same type of ammunition, all these
weapons? All exactly the same. I got three boxes of this Kirky Arsenal ammunition, exactly the same, because I issued it. The same light yellow stuff. The command officer said, no, get them in. And I said, there's no men to go in, sir. They're all out. I said, 11 platoons have been slaughtered. I said, 10 platoons hammered. So, begrudgingly, I think he must have been crying when he ordered the RA, because it's a blow for the CO failing in his first attack. They sent the smoke over, and the HE giving us cover and fire on these bunkers while we got the men out. And I went running back to 10 platoon. I said, right, the gun is in 2 minutes' time, in a short while, they're going to send the smoke and the HE over to give us cover and fire where we will get out. I said, leave the dead, take out what you can, get your wounded out. Well, the living men, there wasn't many of them, the active men, helped the wounded out and were dragging them out. And as a tree had been blown down across the pathway of us, it was a pathway, the men were so badly wounded in legs and things like that, they had to have a clear path. I got a hold of that tree, and God be my judge, how the blazer found the strength to shift that tree. I just hawked it up bodily and twisted it round so the pathway was clear. I just got this tree shifted, and the wounded were staggering out in some awful states, and were looking at me so beseechingly, help me, Sergeant Major, because although they can call you what they like, the Sergeant Major is the kingpin of a company, and the men depend upon you for so much, and you could see them nearly beseeching you for help. And I was giving them all the help I could. I went back and picked up some more wounded, but our own artillery started dropping shells short among us. The few that was coming out started dropping shells among us. Well, everybody squirmed behind a tree and cursing and blaming our own artillery. You cannot blame our lads, because they were dropping shells on the bunkers just in front, and it's such a short distance. Maybe one gun one of the explosions had dropped its sights a bit or gone off aim, and the shells were landing among us. It'd give us one or two more casualties, not many. We were very lucky. It must have been about 10 shells land among us. And we got the men back, and it was unbelievable what was left. So I went to 10, I'd sent a run around to 9 platoon, to 10 platoon, tell them to withdraw, bring all what they had out, leave the bodies, because you cannot encumber yourself with bodies in a situation like this. I thought maybe we could go out of a night time and get the bodies back in. But back we came, and after we'd handed over our wounded, I collected the remnants of the lads up. God be my judge, there was 15 men left. Out of two full platoons, each about 30-odd strong, and company HQ about 8 or 10 strong. You'd say there's about 80 men went in the attack. There was 15 active men left of that. Now, there's no court of inquiry held into that ammunition. Well, I'll continue on with my story. We were standing in a little group behind D Company, waiting for orders what had happened to us. And up come Major Lister Todd with a bag on his back. And he was looking at him. It was his company, you know. He knew that these lads had been killed. Well, he brought them up from youngsters, you know. We looked at each other without speaking, and he slung the bag off his back, and he says, "There you are, Sergeant Major. That's the rum ration your company should have had before you went into action. Somehow, you're the only company that never got the rum ration." Now, that is bad, that, you know. When the only man that was doing the attack never got the rum ration. I'm quite sure they might have been a bit more brave in their attempts, but if the guns are not fine, who can blame them? It seems as if the world's let them down. Everything's let them down when these things won't happen. And, of course, if the section commander's Tommy guns won't fire, I don't know, and I've asked them. But we were stunned, and then the second commander says, "Now, I know you, Sergeant Major. You make sure that the men can drink what they want. You're not going to ration them up two-gallon petrol tins like they used to use in the British Army, or in peacetime. That's what the rum was in." So I give the men a drink of rum. He says, "And you, what's wrong with you?" I said, "Nothing." He says, "Your eyes are all red. The whites of my eyes have turned all red with the explosion, no doubt." He says, "You look ghastly." Well, I was ghastly. When you've been attacked like this, you're not the same man. You're shaking. You're upset at the loss of men, upset the loss of your pals, because they're all pals, and so futile when the guns wouldn't fire. And he said, you get yourself a good drink. And then he says, no, stay here, you're going to get orders about deployment later on. Now, at this time, my head was, all right, and he says, I want you to sit down while everything's lucid, and write down anyone that you think should receive a commendation for gallantry. So I only had the 15 men to sound from, and I asked them. I sat down, and with me field pocketbook, which the sergeant always carries with a message pad, I wrote out recommending two men for an award. One was a lad called Pennington, and the other one was a lad called Beasley. And handed them in, sent a runner back to battalion HQ with them.
What had they done that was...
They were the lads who had gone up on the top of the Bren gun, and apparently from reports had done some good fighting previous to that. But they'd never fired the Bren guns. They'd done some good keeping the men in order, you know, during the scattering. They got the MM, each immediate awards. Now, I was told later on that I'd been put on for an award. Mind, I'll be honest with you. If any man should get a high award, it should have been me on this battle. I got nothing. Not a thing. Because I think the commanding officer would blame me for the ammunition. That's the only thing I can think of. Anyway, the men had a drink and I sat down and I went off the MI room. And I saw the doctor. MI room is the field dressing station. And the doctor has looked in my eyes, probes them. He says, oh, there's nothing wrong. He says, the blood vessels in all your eyes are ruptured. He says, put some drops in. He says, right. He says, nothing I can do. So back I went to the 15 lads. But then the shock of this explosion was affecting us. You know, I don't know what it was. I mean, I'm going to say, and I say it over and over again, I was past the shell shock through France, through what I went through there. But and it must have been, because when I came from France, I was a different man. I was efficient as a soldier, but I always had these sort of headaches and moodiness, and that's that. And I came back to the men, and we got orders to move off to take up a little defensive position. Now, I put the men in the defensive position. I said, we've got no set here. So I went and stuck myself with D Company so that any messages came. I told the sergeant where I was. I said, I'm just down here at D Company. Any information comes through, I'll be back to join you so that we can deal with any situation. Now, we were in reserve. We're in a safe spot. But I went forward with D Company, who were in a forward position. Company commander got killed that night, Major Kelly. Major Kelly. He got killed that same night. And same morning, the morning after. One shot rang out that night. And I remember no more. I remember the thing coming zzzz, and that was it. One machine gun fire went off. And I come to, I was on the bottom of the trench with a stretcher bed, I was looking after us, looking as for where I was hit. I wasn't hit. The explosion round was just past our heads. It had set me head off with this explosion I'd had and just put us out. I was ashamed of it, to think a regular sergeant major had gone down like this. Now, the outcome of it was they decided to send in another battalion in the same places, the same way of fire of attack that we'd done. Now, there's no one questioned me at all on what I found that was the hindrance, what was the obstacles for the men, what would I recommend, what was happening. They sent in the Royal Scots, a company of the Royal Scots. I didn't even know. I was so confused and upset with this shell. Maybe with the help of the rum, I don't know. And I stopped the men drinking the rum, by the way. I'd done, as I said, thought was they had to go into defence position. I wasn't going to have them drunk. And we caught that rum back and we had a canny little drink after all the fighting was over. And the Royal Scots were ordered to do the same attack, exactly the same principle, the same way. I heard the artillery going over, and then I was in this D Company position with the company commander, and the Scots were coming out of this position, come on, give us a hand to get our wounded out. And they were crying, some of them, you know, that received a real piercing. Exactly the same spot as our dead men were. Exactly the same trap of grenades and everything. Now, why the blazes didn't somebody ask me or any of the lads who'd been up that forward position the obstacles? This is lack of forethought, you know. And all we're all so highly trained, all professional soldiers, the hierarchy. But no one asked me a question. Nobody sounded us about the Bren guns and the rifles that wouldn't fire. But an order was sent back to B echelon, and all the Kirky arsenal was taken away and dumped in a river.
What is it? How do you spell Kirky?
K-I-R-K-E-E.
And that's
it's a big arsenal in near Pune where they done all supplies for the Indian Army. Two men I know who are still alive today. One is Sergeant Cotier, who was the Provost Sergeant. He was the A echelon, working with the RSM and ammunition and the quartermaster. And the other fellow is Jack Foster, who was in the guerrilla platoon, who was their base was defence of A echelon after this skirmish with the Japs at Fall Point. And they were ordered to take this ammunition away and get rid of the bloody stuff. The quartermaster told them, get rid of it. And they dumped it in a river. There's plenty of them, deep rivers around there with the water coming from the Mayo Peninsula. Now, they were the only evidence I had of these guns wouldn't fire till last year when I met this lad called Pennington, actually my great friend who just died this last month, Lieutenant Colonel Arnott, told me he'd met a lad who was asking after me, who had the MM, and was thought a great deal of me. He was asking after me and liked to meet me. And he told me the name of him, and I said, oh, Pennington. I thought he was dead. Because, you see, with the other battles that follow, you lose touch with one another. And Pennington, it was. He described him, that was him. And we went down to Winchester, to the Light Infantry Depot, for the annual reunion, which have started, which is a great thing for all the Light Infantry Group. And going through swing doors, who should I bump into? Pennington. And he's an oldish man now. He'd been a pitman. He'd been injured in the leg. But we had a good chat and a good drink together. And I was telling him about the incident of the Bren guns that wouldn't fire. He says, I know they wouldn't fire. We know they wouldn't fire. Because when the men came back, they were all talking about it later on. And everybody knew about them. But there was no inquiry into it. No inquiry into the Thompson submachine guns. Nothing at all. Now, it was a disaster, and yet in all the story, all the books you read about that attack, you don't hear about the guns wouldn't fire. You don't hear about the Tommy guns that blew up. But I'm telling you a factual, actual story of what happens. We took up these positions, and then we went further back. And our Roger Stock came to command the company. We went back to our own reserve positions, and we started getting reinforcements in from our own little group and from what have you.
How long did it take for your shell shock to...
There was no notice taken of it. It was only me that knew it. It went through with me the whole of the war, till after Kohima, that the medical profession noted it. Don't know how they noted it, but I'll tell that story as I come to it.
Did it make you more... Were you more edgy still than you had been?
I was all edgy, yes. Edgy of explosions. That's all I could see. If an odd rifle shot go off, I found it, whereas I'd taken notice of it, I'd jump a bit, I'd flinch a bit. When an explosion went up, I'd jump a bit. But that, you try to hide, you wouldn't let the men see that. Wouldn't let anyone see it. That was your little secret.
What was morale like in what was left of the company?
Shattered. Completely shattered. What the men had been led up to think was they had first-class weapons, first-class support, first-class help in every way, first-class ammunition. Yeah. When we went in the attack, we had nothing but the best. I think that the ruddy rounds were part of some Indian's sabotage. They weakened the amount of brass in the cartridge cases, and or maybe the government given out reducing the amount of brass that had to go into them, and making such a weak cartridge case for a thing. They might have been even skimped in thickness. I don't know. But there was no inquiry other than I don't know the ammunition was dumped. Now, we were making up our company of reinforcements.
What was the new ammunition that replaced it like? Did you have any further trouble?
We went back and got our old ammunition back. I had no more bother. I tell you that I had nearly got... I thought I was going to be blown up with the grenades. I went back and got the ammunition. We were receiving reinforcements. and I took some men up to E Echelon to collect our ammunition. There wasn't many of us left with the old ammunition. We dumped that. We got all our stuff back. And I got the bags of grenades out again. And I was putting my hand in the grenade bag and taking them out. The 36 mils grenades were all right, because you could feel if the pin was in position, that was all right. But I was taking out of a huge bag, a sandbag full of grenades, a 68 grenade. And all around us was troops, because when the echelon, there was some Sikhs and everything washing their clothing and washing themselves down in some water down below. And all around us was troops in this little area. It seemed to be a concentration on them. I thought if shells had landed, they'd really knock some out, but that wasn't my kettle of fish. And I was reaching in this sandbag with the 68 grenades, and I felt, oh, I said, never. One of the tapes had wound the safety cap on the grenade is stuck on with sticky plaster, and it must have come off, and the tape or the fuse in had unwound, and as I drew it out, the fuse had gone, and I could do nothing but stick my steel helmet on the top and hope for the best. I couldn't shout, get out of it. But it so happened, the thing went and just faded out. I'd have been kingdom come. Now the same thing happened to a Sergeant Major of the Royal Berkshires. He blew up with the same sort of thing later on when we're further back up the lane. So I was spared again.
Did you hold the helmet on top of it or what?
I stood on the helmet. The whole lot would have gone up and I'd just been blown to kingdom come, but it might have stopped a little. I never told anybody about it because I was on my own, but that's what happened. Now, later on, I had to go and from the company, again, Roger Stock. We always called him Roger. I knew him as a young training officer. He used to be in the Universal Army. He used to wear the Universal Cab Badge. He used to come to us every year for training. Then he changed the DLI Cab Badge. He says, there's some reinforcements coming back in, Sergeant Major. Go up and meet them, bring them down. He says, just go on your own. Well, it's fair enough. I just picked up my rifle and off I went. I had a rifle now. I wouldn't touch these other automatic weapons. And I went along the pathways to E Echelon and pointed out where the reinforcements would be coming along by truck. And there's a great big expanse of water. And I said, right, because this prickly heat and the filth, you can imagine troops being up the front fighting. No means of having a bath or shower or change of clothing. We stunk. We'd been in the attack, blood on us, helping the wounded and what have you. We were filthy. We did shave, if we had any shaving kit left. But apart from that, we couldn't imagine the smell from ourselves, but we must have stunk, every one of us. You know, we're stuck in these shell holes in the reserve position. The only way you could have washed down, putting water in your mess tin and having a wash down with that. And you didn't get so much water to give these wash downs, but your clothing never got washed. And incidentally, on the same trend, we had white vests, we had white towels, which if you took them out, the Japs could see them. You'd expect it being shot up. They also give us our mosquito nets to take up there. They were single ones, which you hung up in a tree, and they belled out, and you had to sleep under them. Well, again, that was ridiculous. So the first night they were disposed of, we wouldn't touch them again. And then they brought up some anti-malarial ointments that we had to rub on ourselves. It was like a green lot of moss, green oil, we rubbed on ourselves and our faces to keep the malaria off us. Our faces wouldn't move. They all froze up, crinkled tight with this stuff, you know. You couldn't even smile. And that's what we used to have to put on every night while we were up in these reserve positions. Anyway, we stunk to high heavens. So I found an opportunity for a swim. So I stripped off and dived into this water. And I was swimming around happily. And then something bit us and I shot out this water. I didn't know where it was. You always think the snakes, leeches. I said I'd mention leeches later on. This were lying now lying in a wet belt where leeches are prevalent. And I was covered in these black slimy things. Now I didn't even know what they were. They were just like big willicks, hung down, long black things. And they had a big head on them. And they had something, I'd say, like a black snail. Some of them as long as that. And they were stuck to you. And I didn't know they were sucking blood. but they were all over us, and I'm pulling them off us. And the Indians come running up, saying, "Nick, Nick, kitchen, Nick, don't do that." And they got the cigarettes out, and I touched them with cigarettes, and burning them off. Now they said, "Nick," well, I found out later on, when you pull them off, they leave the heads inside you, and you get poisonous. But I did get poisoned through, but I got good healing flesh. But the Indians objected to me being naked. They object to any man showing his privates or anything like that in front of them. They must wear a loincloth or something of that nature.